it felt like really a moment where we could make some change because people were starting to affect change in other spaces across the country as well.
Welcome to The Craft of Campaigns. I'm your host, Andrew Willis Garces. In this podcast, we go behind the headlines and hashtags, inviting movement storytellers to share lessons from social justice campaigns. Campaigns are a series of collective actions focused on winning a concrete demand beyond one-off mobilizations or election cycles. They have villains and heroes, teams that make plans to win, and activate people on the sidelines. In each episode, we explore one campaign through firsthand interviews for key lessons, principles, and practices for organizers today. Friends, we've arrived at our 13th and final episode of this first season, and we're returning to where we started in our introductory episode, to North Carolina, about 40 miles from where I'm standing, in Durham, or Bull City as it's known to the campaigners I've been fortunate to learn from over the last 7 years. This is our third abolitionist campaign story, too. You can check out episodes 4 and 6 to learn about fights for decarceration in Atlanta and Illinois. Somehow, our mighty little team has published over 40,000 words on these campaign stories, which you can download as pretty PDFs or check out abridged versions of on The Forge. And hundreds of you are now tuning in every week. You've sent us inspiring text messages about how these episodes set off light bulbs, had your study groups listen to particular stories, and are starting to send us suggestions for campaigns to unpack next season. As a good campaigner, here's where I deliver our call to action. 100% of this thing was funded by individual supporters like you, and you can quickly and easily make the next season possible at our virtual tip jar at trainingforchange.org/donate. You can also help shape the next season by filling out our listener survey linked in the show notes. Now, I know I said our last episode on the Cap Comcast campaign had it all, but let me give you the trailer for this one as one of Bull City's biggest fans. This is a tale of a new and totally unnecessary police headquarters being proposed soon after thousands marched in the streets demanding justice for Black men killed by police, and the one-off campaign that coalesced to stop its construction. And even though those organizers were unsuccessful, a permanent coalition came together to learn and develop the skills needed to launch their next campaign to force the city council to invest in alternatives to policing, while other Durham activists simultaneously began working to reshape the council itself, developing the ability to recruit and elect champions and mobilize voters who had been sitting out local primary elections. You'll hear about an organization navigating moments of campaign hibernation and head-spinning setbacks, realizing they had to evolve from a coalition into a base-building group, and switching from pressing on the outside to deeply investing in a city's municipal bureaucracy in order to make sure the programs their campaigns won are implemented faithfully. This episode is a little different than others this season. While we usually explore one campaign arc from the perspective of one leader, this episode covers dynamics of a local movement ecosystem with two organizers from Durham Beyond Policing. So you'll hear more from me as a narrator as we tell the story of groups who have worked together over 7 years, playing inside and outside game roles, and who are even now making the leap to create strategies that operate without the state, as one organization, Mi Gente, refers to programs held by people working collectively to create our own solutions to endemic problems like gun violence. AJ Williams is Durham Beyond Policing's co-director of People and Organizing. His political work has included bailing out Black women, femmes, and gender nonconforming caretakers, striving to end the cash bail system and pretrial detention with Southerners on New Ground, and organizing with BYP 100 to address gender-based violence and interpersonal harm. In 2021, he ran for Durham City Council, Ward 3, as the first trans candidate in the history of the city on an abolitionist platform. He served 2 terms as an appointed member of the City of Durham's Participatory Budgeting Steering Committee and is on the movement board of the Cypress Fund. Danielle Purifoy is a Black queer lawyer and geographer at University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Her current research traces the roots of contemporary environmental conditions in the U.S. South, specifically in Black towns dating back to the post-bellum era. Danielle has also written about the legal dimensions of environmental justice and equity in food systems. She's the board chair of the North Carolina Environmental Justice Network and a former race and place editor at Scalawag, a media organization devoted to Southern storytelling. And she's an organizer with Durham Beyond Policing. So let's get into this story. Abolitionist organizers in Durham have, since 2015, diverted more municipal funding to non-carceral approaches to community safety than any other southern city. On a daily basis now, the city's new Community Safety Department and its HEART program, which stands for Holistic Empathetic Assistive Responsive Team, responds to calls about people experiencing mental health crises or other quality of life emergencies with trained clinicians. In the first 7 months of the program's operations, community safety staff responded to 3,000 incidents, 70% of which were redirected away from police to trained clinical social workers, peer support specialists, and emergency medical technicians. And the city now collaborates with the county to fund a neighborhood violence interruption program, Bull City United, as well. These are new investments, and there has been divestment too. In 2019, organizers also blocked a proposal for 72 new police officers, working with champions they had elected to city council over the previous 4 years, to instead redirect $1 million to raise part-time city staff to a $15 an hour minimum wage and increase the budget for eviction diversion. And a year later, they won $1 million for a community safety and wellness task force that would make recommendations to the city, the county, and the school board about additional programs to enhance public safety and wellness that rely on community-based prevention, intervention, and reentry services as alternatives to policing and the criminal legal system. Today, many of those organizers are now leading the design of other neighborhood-based safety programs to complement the new city-staffed department. But their effort to redirect resources away from policing and incarceration did not unfold in a straight line, and they've had significant setbacks in the last 2 years, even as campaign demands they won years ago are finally being implemented. Today, Durham Beyond Policing is attempting to engage hundreds of the city's residents in a durable perspective shift away from traditional carceral approaches to creating safety in advance of their next traditional campaign push, with policy demands, city council targets, and a base to mobilize, to reinvest even more of the city's budget into safety, not police, this spring 2023. It's also a story of organizational flexibility as the organization transitioned from a one-off campaign structure to a formal coalition and then to a base-building organization with its own membership and separate organizational partners. And it's a story of a local movement ecosystem evolving even more rapidly than the national left ecosystem. As this story begins, national and local mobilizations galvanized by outrage over the murders of Black men and boys like Trayvon Martin and the acquittal of the man who shot him, George Zimmerman, in 2012. And in Durham, there were protests and vigils around the death of another boy, Chuy Huerta, a 17-year-old who police said had shot himself in the back of a patrol car in 2013, and around several other killings by Durham police and sheriff's deputies that year. The Durham FADE Coalition was formed, and FADE stood for Fostering Alternative Drug Enforcement, and was a community-led coalition dedicated to exploring the impact of the war on drugs in Durham and focusing on the injustices that occur in the Durham Police Department that disproportionately affect communities of color. And more protests erupted following the murders of Eric Garner, Michael Brown, and Tamir Rice in 2014. One of those inspired to act by joining an organization was Danielle Purifoy, now a leader of Durham Beyond Policing, who relocated to Durham in 2012.
Finishing law school, I moved back to Durham when I was 28 to start a PhD program at Duke in environmental policy and politics. I, at the time that I got here, would not have thought of myself as an organizer. Just for context, I moved back here maybe 4 to 5 months after Trayvon Martin was murdered. And so had started some activism around his murder back in sort of February of 2012 after it happened, and just started following the George Zimmerman case trial as I was going through my first year of grad school. and really was galvanized after his acquittal and was looking for spaces to connect here in Durham. And around that same time, there was a, I think, 17-year-old Latinx kid named Jesus Chuy Huerta, who died in police custody, allegedly with his own gun, who we supposedly shot himself while handcuffed. That was kind of how I got involved in some of the organizing in Durham. This was prior to Durham Beyond Policing coming as a formation. But there was, yeah, some mobilization brewing there. And I ended up becoming part of one of the organizations that founded Durham Beyond Policing, which was Black Youth Project 100, the Durham chapter.
In 2015, community organizers who had waged campaigns for tenant and worker protections, frustrated with the lack of support for bold policy action at the city council level, had decided to pool some of their resources into electing a progressive champion, which was a sharp turn into electoral strategy ahead of when many other Southern campaigners started learning that playbook after the 2016 presidential election. By figuring out how to partner with a longtime progressive political action committee, the Durham People's Alliance, they elected Jillian Johnson on a platform that included support for bold policing reforms. But at the time, she was one of the only council members walking the talk, as Danielle explained.
So Jillian Johnson, one of our city council members who just before all of this started with our campaigns had been elected to the city council on a platform that was the most abolitionist, right? Like that, like that folks had seen, right? And she was, you know, she was elected. I wasn't involved in mobilizing around to get her elected, but she was elected by folks who, the same sort of folks who got involved in, you know, subsequently, right, in these campaigns and mobilizations around policing. But she was one of the first elected officials we had that was, right, like openly critical, right, of policing and the military. I mean, it was, and she got a ton of flack for it. And she kind of stood and held her own, right, like on the council, which, you know, had a different mayor, Bill Bell, back then, and considerably more conservative, right, city council members.
Jillian wasn't able to stop the council from voting to spend $71 million on a new police headquarters. But then in 2016, even after the new headquarters had been approved, local organizers who had been involved in responses to police violence and were carrying out Black Mamas bailout actions and in other responses to the harms of the criminal legal system decided to take a stand against the headquarters, attempting to convince a majority of council members to reverse themselves and invest in what they called a people's budget instead.
I just remember being at one of the BYP 100 meetings and hearing about this new, it was initially $81 million, and then it got sort of knocked down to $71 million for this new police headquarters, which was going to be essentially on East Main Street, and it actually is on East Main Street. And it's important, the geography of the new police station is super important, even though it was just sort of moving maybe like one street over and like to the east from where the then current headquarters was. Because East Durham is Black Durham, right? One part of Black Durham. There are many parts. There are many Black Durhams. But East Durham is one part of Black Durham. The headquarters was built right across the street from public housing. It is a massive, just massive structure in a space where there was already a lot of police presence, right? Like I live in East Durham now. There is, and I can't say because I, you know, what it was like before because I wasn't living here, but the proximity, right, of that police headquarters to the public housing, a lot of which is recently been torn down, by the way, and to the rest of East Durham. But the bottom line was like $71 million, right, for this massive, right, this massive building and this is after, right, this is in the aftermath, like maybe 2 to 3 years after, right, Chuy Huerta dies in police custody. And then also in the aftermath of some deaths, right, at the Durham County Jail. So, and so also at that time, I think it's important to note, there was this group called the Inside Outside Alliance that was folks who, including some folks who then joined DBP, who had been working as via sort of pen pal program with people who were incarcerated at the jail, which is right downtown Durham, right? Sort of right in the center of kind of the sort of revitalization of the city, right? The jail sort of predated a lot of the gentrification, right, of downtown, and now faces like our big performing arts center called DPAC. It's like literally right across the street. So yeah, there, you know, there had been this program of correspondence, right, with people who were incarcerated at the jail. And, you know, we were hearing about people dying at the jail from medical neglect, from all sorts of different abuses, right, not able to really have a steady contact, right, with their loved ones, right, on the outside. And of course, right, this is connected, right, to Song's Black Mama's Bailout, right, campaign as well, right? So all of these sort of things were sort of brewing around the time that this, you know, the $71 million police headquarters comes down. And yeah, just remember there just being a lot of energy and this, you know, around like, this is a shit ton of money, right, to be putting into a system that is literally killing people, right? We need something different. Durham deserves something different. And so it was BYP 100, it was Song, it was our Public Servers Workers Union, UE 150, and a host of other individuals, people representing other organizations, and some folks from the Inside Outside Alliance too, who kind of came together. And that's how Durham Beyond Policing sort of was born as a campaign. It was really just initially thought of as a campaign to try to stop this police headquarters from being built. And so we started showing up to city council meetings, you know, and I think that there was some alarm, right, like on the city council to see all these like young, like queer people, like all of a sudden descending on the council and being like, what do y'all think you're doing, right? Like, what are you doing with this money that is ours, right? Or that we're going to have to pay back, right? You're going to take out this big loan and then we're going to have to be on the hook for paying it back. And so part of that campaign ended up being like people going to, I mean, it was some of everything. It was really, you know, thinking back on it, like, so, you know, so grassroots and so like we were just trying whatever we could to figure out, right? Like, how could we take this down, right? We didn't have a real sense of like city budget processes, right? At that time, like there was a whole lot of learning, right? Our learning curve was very steep for this. But the thing that we did know was that there were better things to use the money on than this police headquarters. So we went into the public housing right across the street from the site of the new headquarters. We talked to people there about their encounters with police, talked to them about what they needed for their housing, right? Like, we need more access to basic services. We don't need a police headquarters right across the street from us. People had all sorts of ideas, right? We went to the bus terminals and asked people, right? Like, what they would use $71 million for. And we created this thing that we called the People's Budget. And we had a rally outside the now what's now the old Durham Police Headquarters. And I just remember there's like, you know, a photo on Durham Beyond Police's like Facebook page, right? Like of this giant circle of people near the old headquarters, like blocking the street. This is like a main thoroughfare to go to downtown Durham. And we had this rally and we read out the People's Budget and people wanted, you know, money for housing, money for better school facilities. They wanted more accessible food, right? Like they wanted all sorts of things that money, right, those public dollars could have gone to that actually keep people safe. And so even though we ended up losing that campaign, right? Like, you know, their response to us was like, we've already voted on it, right? Like, you're too late, right? And that's always their response, right? Like, that's always the response of government, is that, you know, you're always too late for the decision that has been made before you even find out, right? That was on the agenda. But it really, like, the energy around it really galvanized us to start to look at our municipal budgets and to start to pay attention to how our public dollars, you know, particularly from our general fund.
Durham Beyond Policing had been formed by activists from other formations like BYP 100, Southerners on New Ground, and UE 150 as a one-time campaign that failed to achieve its primary goal. But the work crews within the group continued to meet, motivated by a shared interest in understanding how to use the city's budget, as Danielle described.
What I do remember was, like, there wasn't a lot of just sort of, there wasn't a whole lot of folks who just sort of walked away at that point. Like, and I think that was the thing that was remarkable, right? Was that people were like, wait a minute, we have something here. Like, yeah, I mean, we didn't get the police headquarters, but this budgeting thing is kind of, participatory budgeting thing is kind of interesting.
What started as a direct action stunt before a city council vote at one of many protests the group held that spring, the group put out buckets labeled with budget categories like housing and fake money and invited people present to decide how the city's tax revenue should be spent right there on the sidewalk, became a motivating source of continued collaboration as DBP's research squad continued to learn about the budget and how to use the city's official planning process over time.
The tax dollars, right, were being spent in the city. And the thing that we found was that pretty consistently year by year, right, about 60%, right, of the public safety budget, a lot of which comes out of the general fund, is spent on policing. Right. And so that is, like, when you think about public safety budgets, we're talking about, like, everything from fire safety to things like mental health services, like those sort of things. Right. 60% of that budget is consistently, right, across many years. Right. And as it turns out, when we learned more about public budgeting, it's actually a pretty consistent figure across cities across the country, is that, like, public safety is like 60% of that budget is typically going to cops, right? And that really got us thinking, right? For our budget in Durham, for just the city budget, what that meant was, like, 60% of the public safety budget amounted to almost a third, right, of, like, our general fund. And that's massive. That's a massive amount of money when we have so many unmet needs, right, that could very much, right, and more purposefully and more successfully, right, contribute to our collective safety. And so that's kind of how Durham Beyond Policing started to evolve beyond just a campaign and into more of a loose coalition formation. We have gone back and forth, right, in many ways over the years about, like, exactly what Durham Beyond Policing is. But I think, right, after we lost that initial campaign and there was still so much energy around the budget, it was kind of clear that we were going to continue in some form or fashion to start thinking about how we could, you know, defund, right, like, the police and actually reinvest in the things that keep us safe.
Some turned their attention to a way to bring that action into reality by advocating for the city to establish a participatory budgeting program, which would not only allow them to allocate $2.5 million to neighborhood projects as voted on by Durhamites, but would also give them an ongoing way to develop more buy-in from more people in Durham who wanted police reform, that the budget and the city council were a key point of leverage. They work with Jillian and other inside game allies to shepherd legislation through council to create what is now one of the country's largest participatory budgeting programs. AJ Williams, who joined Durham Beyond Policing as a member in 2016 and now serves as the organization's co-director, spoke about how the group used the campaign to develop their organizational members' analysis around relating to the city budget as a key source of leverage.
There were folks who were already part of DBP as the campaign to push back against the $71 million police headquarters being built. But losing that fight meant that we actually won participatory budgeting for the city, which was like this direct democracy experiment that was happening. You know, we didn't really know what we wanted. We knew that we were interested in creating some other vehicle, right? That was a policing alternative, particularly as these pockets, like in the country, police shootings were happening.
Meanwhile, throughout 2016 and 2017, the group continued to channel grassroots outrage against incidents of police brutality, and at one point tried to use the police department's accreditation process as a point of leverage.
So I remember in 2017, I'm pretty sure it was 2017, there was a teenager, I think she was 17 years old. Her name was Eunice Fennell, and she died allegedly by suicide in the jail. There was also someone, and it may have been 2016, but it was around the same time. There were like three people, right? I think between 2015 and 2017, and probably more, but there are these three people who kind of we got to know more about, who died in the jail from either medical neglect. You know, Eunice Fennell was in this adult jail, right? And had been harassed. And, you know, what they allege is that she committed suicide at that jail. Frank Clark, that also happened in 2017, I think, either 2016 or 2017, like around Thanksgiving. Frank Clark, who was from McDougal Terrace, right? The same public housing facility that had to be evacuated because of carbon monoxide a few years later, just pre-COVID, he was killed by police. So the confluence, right, of like those issues, right, those happenings really kept people's attention and kept us together, right, in a lot of ways, like thinking, you know, in the sense that like we really do need to focus more and work harder and, you know, think and strategize about how we're going to take down this system. Around the time of the campaign around the police headquarters, there was also this accreditation process to re-up essentially or renew the police department's accreditation. And, you know, at that time, we didn't know that police were accredited by anybody, right? They were undergoing review. And at that time, the police chief was this guy named Jose Lopez, who was, you know, notorious for overlooking, right, various forms of police harassment and abuse. When Chuy Huerta was killed, right, there was a whole kind of uprising around his leadership or lack thereof and all of these sort of things. So he was in hot water. And this accreditation process came about around that same time. And so there was folks from Song, right, from BYP 100, essentially the same people involved in Durham Beyond Policing that started pushing for the police department to not be have its accreditation renewed. So I remember we attended and spoke at hearings for the accreditation as well. And there's some photo of us right after that process too, with like signs like, you know, police accreditation fails, like, you know. Yeah, so there were, you know, sort of the bottom line was that so many things were happening, right, just in Durham, and then also, right, like connected with mobilizations across the country, right? You know, the killing of Michael Brown, right? My goodness, Philander Castile, like it just, you know, Sandra Bland, right? Like all of those things were happening at this national level and these other locales at the same time that we were experiencing our own losses and tragedies, right? And various abuses. And so it just really kept us going, you know, and it felt like really a moment where we could make some change because, you know, people were starting to affect change in other spaces across the country as well.
At the same time as they continued to work in an ad hoc way, responding to moments of outrage, some within the wider Durham movement ecosystem were working to recruit and support other future elected champions to join Jillian Johnson at the city council and later the county commission in advance of the 2017 municipal election.
In 2017, you know, I think it was, you know, the moment happening, right, nationwide, but also the mobilizations that were happening in the city around policing and incarceration, that meant that any of the people who were running for city council had to have something to say, right, about policing. They had to have a stance on it, right? And we decided as Durham Beyond Policing that we were going to actually have a forum to make them, right, account for it, right, to ask those questions. And, you know, part of that was because the political PACs, right, even the liberal political PACs in our city, right, weren't necessarily asking those sort of questions, right? They may have said something about, you know, public safety or like preventing police abuses or reform, right? But, you know, we wanted to know, you know, what is your stance on thinking about redistributing resources away from policing and towards something else?
All of the protests and city council mobilizations, the workshops on the police and public safety budgets were also fueling interest in electing people who would walk the talk once they were in office. It was with that backdrop that many of Jillian's campaign organizers used the infrastructure they built when she ran for her seat to form Durham for All, a new permanent electoral base building formation, and which turned both to developing year-round engagement with voters on issues like policing and recruiting others to run. Because they were a 501c4, they could also engage their members in formally endorsing and signing up to help elect candidates. And as the last piece of the puzzle needed to elect champions from their ranks, organizers within grassroots formations started collaborating with a longtime progressive institution, the Durham People's Alliance PAC, which had over several decades built a consistent following among Democratic primary voters who valued their endorsements, serving a role similar to that of the Working Families Party in many Northeastern states. And in 2017, they elected two more progressives to join Jillian, Vernetta Alston and Steve Shule. And just emphasizing the importance of a local ecosystem in which people are willing to play different roles to take advantage of unique moments of opportunity, Vernetta's candidacy was supported by people who hadn't yet started to show up for electoral work when Jillian ran for office. And a member of the local teachers union stepped up to be her campaign manager. A few months after she was elected, there was an unexpected vacancy on the city council, and activist Javiera Caballero was appointed by the full council after receiving an endorsement vote from the membership of the Durham People's Alliance. Progressives now had four reliable votes on the council for the first time, a governing majority, all of whom had been shaped by Durham Beyond Policing's issue campaigns. Later that year, an overlapping coalition of local groups that included Durham for All also supported the candidacies of a reform-oriented sheriff and district attorney who won their primaries and the general election and immediately implemented policies pushed by local organizers, like ending voluntary cooperation with ICE and prosecuting fewer people for low-level offenses. They both ousted incumbents who had previously had no trouble getting elected with more conservative policies. Organizers had shifted what was politically possible using both electoral and issue-based campaigns, which continued into the following year, as the work Southerners on New Ground had piloted, which we heard about in episode 4 of this podcast, bailing out Black women on Mother's Day, not only expanded, but also started to include direct action protests drawing attention to the continued use of bail itself. But Durham's city manager and police chief, in crafting the city's budget proposal for the city council the following year, evidently did not see the writing on the wall. They initially asked for 72 new police patrol positions, causing Datra Jackson of BYP 100 to raise the alarm to her mostly dormant Durham Beyond Policing coalition partners, as AJ explained.
Just to kind of lay out what happened, we receive an email. We're holding meetings like every few days. We're all kind of like, all right, let's do a proposal for a task force. We're all like simultaneously signed into one Google document that we're like copy editing and writing at the same time. So it was just like pretty much figuring out who was in the room and what to call ourselves and under what banner to operate. So, yeah, I think, you know, we had a lot of energy and didn't really know what the precise approach was going to be. You know, we would have these huge meetings and that's when we really started figuring out like, okay, like who here is good at what?
The group had developed serious budget policy expertise in their previous fights. And not only were they ready to push back against the police chief's talking points, they quickly crafted a proposal for a city and county funded task force, which would design and then request funding for programs that would create real community safety. This wouldn't just be a no campaign. This would be about bringing a collective vision of alternatives to policing and the criminal legal system into reality. And with four solid no votes against new police funding on the city council, DBP decided to use the budget vote as an opportunity for a visionary action that would show the power they had created and invite anyone watching into a piece of the visionary organizing to come.
We knew that our approach to city council had to be something that was different and outstanding. And so we called in Toshi Regan and, you know, we made a decision that we wanted to sing Going to Get My Baby Out of Jail. Toshi taught us this song at North Star Church of the Arts. And so we had kind of like a rehearsal the evening before. We learned the lyrics. We had like lyric sheets printed up. And yeah, the night of the city council meeting where they were supposed to vote, we went in, you know, some like 300-400 of us. And it wasn't all folks who were like DBP, like under that banner, but, you know, you had folks who were fighting for the eviction diversion program to get funded. You have folks who were seeking to get increased wages, a livable wage for all city workers as well. But we were all there together, like with a common goal to get collective resources for our people. So, you know, we show up, we had printed out like hundreds of these proposals overnight. I remember because I was one of the people who printed them, me and Munju. And yeah, we showed up and we began to sing and we were passing out the proposals to like the clerks and we were like, can you give these to the city council members? And they were passing them down. So it was really cool to see, like, you know, I think often when we're planning actions, right, we're trying to think of the thing that like gets the most shock value, or like what's the means to the end? Like, what do we need to do to get their attention? And often those things require us to like put our bodies on the line in ways that can really get us killed, you know, thinking about the stuff that's happening in Atlanta right now. And, you know, we make those choices as organizers to step out in that way. But very seldom are there things that we do in terms of actions that are like rooted in like joy, or like this communal singing piece was just like so different and folks were so excited about it. And so, yeah, we won in a 4-3 vote. We got the task force approved.
The city council rejected the police department's request for a compromise number, 18 additional patrol officers, during a budget work session. Instead of the $1.2 million for new police funding advocated by the city manager, the council voted to allocate $650,000 to increase pay for the city's part-time workers to $15.46 an hour. It was a historic win for progressives and immediately made national news. Durham Beyond Policing, revitalized by the rapid response campaign and the proposal they had developed, began fleshing out their vision for the Community Safety and Wellness Task Force, meeting with other organizations, with elected officials and city and county staff to get feedback on and build support for making it a reality.
I think at some point we did land, like, there are a number of us who were having kind of one-on-one meetings with electeds. And, you know, when it all comes down to it, like, the craft of the campaign, part of it is like you have to identify like who your targets are, like what are you trying to change and who has the power to do that. And so I think that's really when we started like taking a deep dive into like the budget stuff, and we call them our budget fights. Like, you know, for a few years that was just what we were wrapped up in, because that's where the resource allocation for the things that people actually need lies. And it's more complicated in Durham, right? Because we have a city budget and we have a county budget, and a lot of the kind of public health related things are in the county budget. And then there are like infrastructure things that are in the city budget. So it's almost like a dual fight oftentimes when you're thinking about like bail and the sheriff and parole and mental health services, all those things are in the county.
Their vision was to use an appointed multi-governmental work group to generate policies and new programs that would be used by the city of Durham, Durham County government agencies, and Durham Public Schools. They met with local teachers' union leaders, with groups of formerly incarcerated people, with people who had survived violence, but it was still on the drawing board heading into 2020. And in a setback, Vernetta Alston left her council seat to join the North Carolina legislature, which left movement forces with only three solid votes as the uprising following George Floyd's murder convulsed the city in the summer of 2020. As in many other cities across the South, protests took place almost daily during the height of what local organizers often refer to as budget season, when municipal budgets are marked up and approved by the end of June each year. Durham Beyond Policing knew this was a key opportunity, and they quickly channeled grassroots anger into their existing demand for the city to fund the safety task force. The city council voted to approve the task force and allocate $1 million in funding to get it off the ground. Durham Beyond Policing successfully persuaded city council to vote against a $600,000 five-year taser contract for the Durham Police Department around the same time. But once the summer of protests had cooled off, they still didn't have support from the county commission. And the uprising energy had exposed a weakness in the local movement ecosystem. Hundreds of people wanted to join DBP's campaign, but there wasn't a right-sized organizational container for them. So the group's leadership decided to convert its structure from a coalition to a base-building group with its own individual membership and with staffing.
I remember that year we held a people's budget hearing, and that happened right after George Floyd was murdered. And so we saw this like uptick in folks who really wanted to engage, who were like activated by that moment and wanted to plug in. And so I think at that time, because we had been operating so small, like it was only, you know, maybe 10 of us who were like consistently meeting kind of post task force proposal approval. It was like a little bit jarring and a little overwhelming, right? To have like 300-400 folks who are like, we want to be DVP members. And so we really had to like start evaluating ourselves as like, we're growing, right? We're growing and we want to be able to absorb all this interest and, you know, energy and enthusiasm to do something. And also like figuring out like, okay, what structure do we take? Like is it a campaign anymore? Are we an organization, you know, like, and yeah, that felt like an interesting moment to be in.
That shift allowed them to put more consistent pressure on elected officials and to help drive turnout during the fall primary and general elections in partnership with other organizations that were interviewing and endorsing candidates. And finally, in November, a progressive candidate supported by Durham for All, the People's Alliance, and other local groups, Nida Alam, was elected to the county commission, giving the local ad hoc pro-decriminalization alliance a 3-vote majority on the commission. In the next month, the county formally joined the Safety and Wellness Task Force. The task force finally had its first meeting in April 2021, kicked off with an overview of the campaign that had brought it into being, offered by Durham Beyond Policing members themselves. Over the next year, members of the group worked inside and outside the task force itself to make recommendations through its different official work groups, including proposals involving the protocols, principles, and personnel of the new Community Safety Department. Durham Beyond Policing's outside game agitators were now on the inside too, and true to their role as organizers, they used their positions to host listening conversations with communities across the city, bringing municipal employees and elected leaders with them as they used public feedback to craft proposals for the new department. As one DBP member told me, they had to create a shift inside their local government to decision-making that valued what community members were saying they needed and wanted around compassionate, skilled, human-centered responses to harm and violence. Before the task force and the newfound willingness of city employees staffing the new department to listen, there weren't any avenues to shape policy around harm and violence. It was just call the police or don't. DBP leaders were also determined to learn from other local organizers' experiences with a previous city task force, the Workers' Rights Task Force, which was designed to come up with ways local governments could protect workers in a state that had all but banned the measures that other city governments were allowed to take. The groups that won that victory didn't recruit their members to join or participate in its creation, which some believed had been an error. Durham Beyond Policing was determined not to take their hands off the wheel after the initial victory establishing the Safety and Wellness Task Force.
So the task force has played a really crucial role in number one, gathering information and stories and data from residents about how they experience crisis response. And so that kind of flow of information, you know, was received by the community safety department through the city. And, you know, that work, or like that work in tandem, the task force and the department, which, you know, like we got a $1 million placeholder to create the department, and then ended up in another situation where we realized that that pilot needed to really be robustly resourced and funded, and didn't know if like $1 million was going to cut it, or like if a few staff members were going to cut it. And so we actually worked with Durham For All to launch the Tend to Transform campaign, where we were trying to get the vacancies that already existed in the Durham Police Department like transferred over to the Community Safety Department.
In 2021, the goal of the Tend to Transform campaign was to get 10% of the police department's funding reallocated to community safety. Still lacking a clear council majority, that budget campaign fell short of its goals, only succeeding in reallocating 5 vacant police positions to the department. In that year, the local progressive ecosystem infrastructure that had been so critical in electing progressive champions, struggling to rise above internal challenges, and a national wave of pro-police Democrats like New York's Eric Adams, failed to elect a council majority, with Durham For All's endorsed candidates all falling short of victory, including AJ Williams, who lost by only 600 votes. His evolution from Song and BYP 100 member, an outside game agitator, to someone who took one for the team, as he says, to serve as a movement candidate during an election cycle when progressive forces were expecting to be defeated, wasn't straightforward.
You know, I sat with it, and immediately when I put it out to a few people, I felt the excitement, because I think folks understood my kind of trajectory of like involvement in Durham and Durham organizing. And so that instilled a little more confidence in like, okay, maybe I can do this, you know? And I think just like, it really did feel like a kind of like, I don't want to say a scarcity moment, but I don't think folks were really enthused to like run, you know? So yeah, I just was really clear. It was like, if not me, then who? And, you know, sometimes you got to take one for the team. So I was like, you know, let's do it. Like, it felt like I had strong community support to really step out there. And I'm an introvert, so it's saying a lot to make a decision of this capacity. Like, it is a lot emotionally, spiritually, physically. There's also like the nature of running during the campaign. The campaign trail, quote unquote, looked a lot different. It was a lot of Zoom calls, a lot of Zoom fatigue. And, you know, I was running on a really explicitly abolitionist platform, right? Like, saying it without saying it, but just straight up, like, folks knew me to have a strong interest and desire in dismantling the Durham Police Department. And, you know, a few months before that, our previous police chief, who's now in Memphis, who I can imagine is coming under fire because of the recent shooting that involved the 4 police officers with the young man named Tyree. Yeah, like, she ended up going down to Memphis and et cetera, et cetera. But like, I just felt really clear that, you know, there's these moments in your life where you have to make a decision. And I knew that it would impact my family. I knew that it would impact my mental health. I didn't know quite in what ways until I was fully in it. But, you know, I would make that decision all over again, because I know when we're trying to organize, who is in office really determines so much about the organizing landscape and the wins that you're actually able to secure. It's really important that you have electeds who have their ear to the street, who really get it. And I knew that I could play that position really well with this like intersection of like, all right, if I'm on council, I'm still connected to community in such a way that I can get things through. And so that was really the plan. It was like, you know, And like I said, I had amazing community support the entire way through. And so to lose that race really felt like a few things became clear. One was that there were 14,000 plus people in Durham who were ready for an abolitionist platform and candidate, right? It was ready to move in that direction. And that defund the police was not just some like small like pocket of folks who, you know, wanted to make cities less safe for everybody. Like, this was like a thing that a lot of people could get behind. And I really feel like that energy we really tried to keep in moving away from like being in these rapid response moments, but actually saying like, okay, there is something here, right? We can galvanize our community members who we know are supporters of our vision and get them engaged in such a way that they feel empowered to like be a part of a process that actually centers their voices, their experiences, where, you know, because with critical participatory action, it's like the folks in the community are the researchers. And so they are bringing forth the information that informs how the process goes the entire time. For a candidate who was, you know, openly trans, black, queer, from Durham, and, you know, I experienced a lot of like really kind of devastating moments where folks took shots at my identity with the plan to like decrease the amount of votes I got. But ultimately, I see it as a win. I think it gave us two additional years to make our base stronger, to really deepen relationships with community members. And that's what we're focused on right now.
But despite the losses and a clear pro fully funding the police council majority that came into office at the end of 2021, the Community Safety Task Force has continued. And the gains DBP inspired and helped create in 2019 and 2020 have reshaped the material conditions for many. Even though the new council increased the police budget by 10% in 2022 and signed a contract with ShotSpotter Corporation for a gunshot surveillance technology pilot program, they also reallocated 7 more non-police positions to the new safety department. And the task force work groups have met nearly every week since April 2021. And many of the group's members have molded the city's new community safety department and its community response program, HEART, which sends trained clinicians rather than armed police in response to 911 calls in 2 neighborhoods during specific hours of the day. Over its first 8 months, the program responded to nearly 3,000 incidents, either in conjunction with police or independently, diverting nearly 70% of the calls they received from the police to trained social workers. DBP has also leaned more into its new role as organizing or base building hub and is currently launching a community education program designed to build an energized base to advocate for 24/7 funding for the HEART program in the coming municipal budget process and to expand it to neighborhoods across the city. They've also reflected on the need to help communities develop even more granular community safety programs held outside city or county agencies, and are rolling out a series of workshops to help people in the neighborhoods impacted by gun violence to design interventions that could be carried out by neighbors themselves. That means in 5 short years, they've evolved not only their structure from a one-off campaign to a coalition to a base-building group with its own membership, but also they've grown their strategy toolkit from being outside game agitators or rebels to inside game advocates trying to support key city staff to implement their visions, and now helping create alternative institutions that can function outside official channels.
The Craft of Campaigns podcast is a project of the Organizing Skills Institute at Training for Change and made possible by grassroots donors. Visit Training for Change for workshops, training tools, and other resources. We welcome your feedback and nominations for other campaigns that should be featured on this podcast. If you like these episodes, please consider donating to keep the show running. This podcast is produced by Ali Roseberry Pollier. I'm Andrew Willis Garces. See you next time.